This is Shelley Welton, and I'm here today with Annie Eisenberg, who's an assistant professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, where she founded the Environmental Law Clinic and teaches property, water law, and a seminar on the urban-rural divide. So Annie, thank you so much for being with me today. We're going to talk about an article that we will also hyperlink on the website of hers called Just Transitions. Does it have a subtitle?
Just Transitions.
Okay, thanks for being here with me today.
Thank you for having me.
So, you talk in the article about this growing discourse around the idea of just transitions and a lack of clarity over what is meant by the phrase when people use it. So, I thought I might ask you to start by answering just a couple background questions about this concept. So, the first is, why do you think there's such growing interest in the idea of just transitions right now?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And so, it seems like more and more people are waking up to the fact that the need for decarbonization is more urgent than we may have realized, especially as we're already seeing changes in weather patterns around the world. And so once you accept that we need to take some pretty drastic steps to transition to a low-carbon economy, ideally pretty quickly, which in large part involves shifting away from the use of fossil fuels in energy production, it becomes clear that we need a massive restructuring of society, which is going to have a lot of fallout and potential for both harms and benefits to be distributed across different populations. And so the idea broadly of a just transition is that we want to acknowledge and address those risks of unfairness in the transition and ensure that it's just, so to speak.
Great. So that leads me to the other question that I had as sort of a background question about this concept, which is, you write in your piece about how people are using this phrase differently, and you have a preferred definition. So I thought I'd get you to talk a little bit about sort of how people are using it and what your preferred conception of the phrase is.
Yeah, so my first task in digging into this increasingly popular phrase and trying to understand it was a literature review. And I did a literature review across disciplines. And it seemed like even within and across disciplines, there were two main meanings that people were using this same term for. And so one way people use it is what I call the broad version, which is pretty much using the term in the colloquial way that it sounds like. We want a fair transition, generally. So it's sort of a call to make sure that the world's vulnerable are generally not hurt by the transition. And in fact, for some, it's the idea that the transition should be used to undo all of the inequalities that we've seen as a pretty fundamental part of the carbon-based economy. And then the second common usage that I call the narrow version, it's a usage that's referring specifically to the risk of mass displacement of communities that have historically depended on fossil fuels economically, and the need to try to counteract that specific risk. So I advocate for using the second meaning, the narrower one, as a focal point for a few reasons. So first, just transition, it's actually a term of art, and it evolved out of labor activism. And a lot of people and institutions around the world, including the International Labor Organization and other United Nations bodies, already recognize this as a labor concept. And second, I do think that the values suggested by the broad version are absolutely important. But I'm not sure that that's the niche this concept should fill. So when we think, when I think we in the environmental world have this need to engage more with considerations of labor and economic dependency, and we already have a set of justice concepts relating to climate change-related transitions like climate justice, energy justice, or environmental justice. So I think that the narrow version is exciting because it's under this environmental umbrella, but it's mostly about labor and economic equity, which environmental theory has not really been particularly strong on historically.
I think that's a really interesting point you make about the way it could strengthen the environmental movement to narrow this terminology. So one of the reasons that I'm excited about featuring your work in the Energy Trade-Off series is that I think it's one of the projects that best scrutinizes the really tangible, painful costs that there are going to be associated with the transition to clean energy, as much as we think it's absolutely necessary. So I was wondering if you could just paint this picture a little bit more fully for us in terms of who and where are we worried about in discussions over ensuring a just transition in the conception of the phrase that you're using?
Yeah, and so that's another good question. And how we define who and where we're worried about really depends on the scope of our focus. And so I have often been focused on Appalachian communities that were either historically dependent on coal or still are. And if people are interested in learning more about this, I would recommend a paper that recently came out through the Brookings Institute called The Risk of Fiscal Collapse in Coal-Reliant Communities, and details this problem really well. So I often am using Appalachia and coal-reliant communities as a focal point, but I think similar considerations apply to coal communities in western states as well, like in Wyoming, Colorado, and North Dakota. We're hearing a lot about plant and mine closures out there these days. But this really could, when we talk about decarbonization, it goes far beyond coal, too. We should generally be asking what other industries have high carbon emissions and who risks being displaced when we reduce those emissions. I do think there is something specifically interesting about rural communities that have evolved around one industry specifically, which is what we see with these coal-reliant communities, which is maybe a unique problem in and of itself.
So just to follow up on that, I mean, we're not hearing a lot of conversation around just transitions and natural gas, but should we be starting that conversation now?
That's a good question. I think that we have to recognize a few realities surrounding economies based on fossil fuels or natural resource extraction generally, which is that they were never designed to be sustainable. They were kind of, by definition, never going to be sustainable. I do think that natural gas and fracking is a little different from coal in that it's been a quicker kind of economic growth. And I suspect that the boom-bust cycle is not going to be quite as dramatic as what we've seen with coal. But absolutely, communities that have maybe replaced coal with natural gas, the natural gas isn't always going to be there, and they need to be thinking about transitioning as well.
So to get a little bit more into the question of what transitioning means in this context, you often hear these conversations about bringing in a new factory or retraining workers in a particular way as a solution to some of these just transition problems. And I know in your view that this isn't enough. So I wanted to just get you to say a little bit about why you think that these kinds of really popular solutions fall short.
Yeah, so we often end up focusing on jobs and numbers of jobs lost, which leads us to ask the question of, okay, how can we replace those jobs? How can we swap out 100 jobs lost for 100 jobs gained? But I think my view on this is very much informed by what I was saying about rural economic development. It's not just that natural resource-based economies are unsustainable. Economies that have one industry or mono economies were also not sustainable. So having one industry or employer prop up a region actually wasn't a great idea in the first place. So it doesn't make sense to me to swap out one basis for a relatively weak economy with another. And I think worker retraining has a few different complications for why it isn't necessarily an effective approach. It doesn't account, unless you have a comprehensive kind of package that you're thinking about, worker retraining doesn't necessarily account for where new jobs are going to be, whether people want those particular jobs. And we also have to ask whether we're concerned about, in the transition from one sector to another, are they going to be transitioning to are we retraining people for substantially worse jobs? lower paying jobs, jobs without benefits, and if so, do we care? So in my view, what needs to happen is to recognize that these communities have essentially experienced a form of non-development for decades, if not a century or two, and we need to think about how to do it right going forward, which I think should involve a combination of planning, economic diversification, building the capacity of regional institutions like local governments, enhancing educational opportunities more broadly in addition to worker retraining, and then efforts to counteract the heightened risk of poverty in communities in decline.
Great. So one of the other things your piece does, I think very usefully, is turn to some real-world examples of where government has tried to design policies that actually create more just economic transitions in the past. And I thought I might ask you to just pick one of the examples that you use in the paper and describe, you know, where did it succeed and where did it fall short?
Yeah, so I think the most analogous precedent we have to the decarbonization and the coal reliance question would be the President's Northwest Forest Plan. That was in the state of Washington when in the early 1990s, timbering on public lands was cut back for conservation reasons. And it was cut back somewhat abruptly and somewhat severely. So an initial injunction from a federal court prohibiting timbering displaced between 60,000 and 100,000 workers. And so the Clinton administration's Northwest Forest Plan tried to offset some of the suffering associated with that displacement. And the plan involved a variety of approaches, including measures to try to promote regional entrepreneurialism and grow the manufacturing sector. Probably the hallmark of the program from an economic development lens was direct subsidies to timber-dependent counties, which worked well to kind of stop the bleeding for a while, but more recently those subsidies have been reduced, and those counties have been described as being in a state of crisis because of that. The forest plan did achieve important conservation purposes in the region, but a fair amount of commentary suggests that it really didn't go far enough to ensure sustainable change. And so, you know, maybe the ideas that I proposed, that mechanisms for planning and economic diversification and education and a view towards sustainable change might have helped avoid kind of the cycle of the region had the rug pulled out from under it once with the loss of timbering and again with the loss of the subsidies.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is the last question I have for you. We're doing this interview in the middle of primary season, so I feel like I can't help but ask about politics a little bit. So there's lots of talk among all of these Democratic presidential hopefuls right now about the best way to move forward on federal climate policy. And most candidates have endorsed some version of a Green New Deal, although I don't think they all mean the same thing when they say it. So I thought I would ask you if you could advise these candidates on how issues of a just transition should be built into federal climate legislation, what would you recommend to them?
Yeah, that's a really good question that I will ideally write an entire paper on at some point.
We'll do another one of these. Then.
Yes, and so I do think there's such a good potential for synergy here. I think the Green New Deal sounds like exactly the right prescription for fossil fuel-dependent communities. They've had environmental devastation. They've had economic devastation. And then these sort of justice and equity considerations that go with essentially being a sacrifice zone. So a program that was designed to pursue environmental aims, reduce carbon emissions, environmental restoration, and economic growth distributed equitably sounds like just the right approach to me. In terms of more specific prescriptions, I'm not against jobs. I'm not against trying to create jobs for people. I guess I'm skeptical of public-private partnerships or efforts to, people seem to want to find the secret formula to lure employers to a particular place, which obviously for a place that's been, you know, underdeveloped and struggling for decades, that's going to be a huge task. I did a quick Google about Solyndra before I came over here. I'm not really sure what the circumstances surrounding that were. I know it's an example of an attempt at a kind of a public-private green energy initiative, and it did not work out. And so I was thinking one thing I would love to see with jobs and employment is to see what I think would be a more accountable, more reliable employment prospect, which is publicly created jobs, which the Green New Deal seems very well poised to do, and which would mirror the Civilian Conservation Corps from the original New Deal, which put a lot of people to work doing a lot of important things. So I think that that's something I would want them to consider. If we're talking about regional revitalization as part of the Green New Deal, I think it's really important that there has to be a mechanism for input from people who live in the regions in question. There's sort of a long history of questionable dynamics between government institutions and those regions, which I know we've both read Stephen Stahl's Ramp Hollow, which I think illustrates that really well. Mm-hmm. And so the history of those dynamics is very old, and there's mistrust, and I think it's also very easy for well-intentioned outsiders to come up with the wrong solution. So something informed by local and regional input, I think, is going to be the best approach.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you for having me.